pure passion and sensuality into harmony with the ordering principle of the Spirit. This was represented symbolically as dissolution of the dead king and his subsequent regeneration after eating the miraculous food, which is the beneficial aspect of the unknown and the hero simultaneously. The second final aim was reintroduction of the integrated psychic structure to the physical body, the conscious incarnation of the now more complete spirit. So this meant that the union attained by the reincorporation of the material unknown was not complete if it was still a matter of philosophy or abstract conceptualization. The well-integrated spirit also had to be realized in behavior. And this was not necessarily yet even the final stage. The alchemist Dorn states, as cited by Jung, "We conclude that meditative philosophy consists in the overcoming of the body by mental union, unio mentalis. This first union does not as yet make the wise man, but only the mental disciple of wisdom. The second union of the mind with the body shows forth the wise man, hoping for and expecting that blessed third union with the first unity, the unus mundus, the latent unity of the world. May Almighty God grant that all men be made such, and may He be one in all." Dorn's ideas referred to a conjunction conceptualized as a three-stage process. The first stage was union of the mind, the overcoming the body by mental union. This stage refers to the integration of states of motivation, drives, emotions, into a single hierarchy dominated by the figure of the exploratory hero. The second stage was reunion of the united mind with the body. This is analogous to the second stage of the hero's journey. After the treasure is released, consequential to the battle with the dragon, the purely personal aspect of the hero's journey is completed. After all, he has found the treasure hard to attain. But the hero must return to the community. This is equivalent to Buddha's determination to retire from the state of nirvana until all who were living could make their home there. Is tantamount to the Buddha's belief that the redemption of the one was impossible in the presence of the unredeemed many. The reunion of the united mind with the body is inculcation of proper attitude in action, and is, therefore, the effect of the hero on the world. The third stage is particularly difficult to comprehend. Reconsideration of the theme of the tailor who mends, and who can therefore sew up the hole in the sky made by the dying king, might help with initial comprehension. Things that are wrong must be set right. This is a psychological process, even if undertaken purely as a consequence of actions conducted in the outside world. The union of the united spirit/body with the world means recognition of the essential equivalence of all experience, or consideration of all aspects of experience as literally equivalent to the self. We presume the existence of a final barrier between subject and object, but a standpoint exists that gives to all aspects of individual experience, whether subjective or objective, equal status as aspects of experience. Redeeming any aspect of that experience, then, whether material or psychological, whether self or other, is then regarded as the same act, as the act whose purpose is establishment of the kingdom of God, which is simultaneously psychological and social state. Spiritual work may therefore be regarded as indistinguishable from work on the external circumstances of existence. Redeem yourself, redeem the world. Or, alternatively, the attempt to bring about the perfection of the external world may be regarded as equivalent to the attempt to perfect oneself. After all, dedication to an ideal necessitates development of self-discipline. This is voluntary apprenticeship. The world and the self are not different places. From this perspective, all is experience. The attempt to redeem either necessarily brings about redemption in the other. All three of these conjunctions may be represented symbolically by the syzygy, the divine union of opposites, most generally considered as male and female. Number one, first, known, previous knowledge subsumed under patriarchal spiritual category, plus unknown, anomaly subsumed under matriarchal affective material physical category, equals united spirit. Two, then united spirit, in this context, subsumed into the patriarchal spiritual category, plus body, subsumed under matriarchal material category, equals united spirit body. Three, then united spirit body, in this context, subsumed under the patriarchal spiritual category, plus world, matriarchal material category, equals united spirit body world. All three of these unions can be considered variants of the incest motif. Brother, sister, son, mother, king, queen pairings. Stage one, the mental union, was construed as necessary, valuable, but incomplete. The attainment of an ordered subjective state, stage two, was another important step along the way. Jung cites the alchemist Dorn once again. Learn, therefore, O mind, to practice sympathetic love in regard to thine own body by restraining its vain appetites, that it may be apt with thee in all things. To this end I shall labor, that it may drink with thee from the fountain of strength, and, when the two are made one, that ye find peace in their union. Draw nigh, O body, to this fountain, that with thy mind thou mayest drink to satiety, and hereafter thirst no more after vanities. O wondrous efficacy of this fount, which maketh one of two, and peace between enemies! The fount of love can make mind out of spirit and soul, but this maketh one man out of mind and body. The third step, however, was critical. Philosophical knowledge and ordered intrapsychic structure, even when embodied, was regarded as insufficient. That embodied union must be extended to all the world, regarded as an aspect of experience, and therefore as equivalent, even identical, to the self. The alchemical procedure was based on the attempt to redeem matter, to transform it into an ideal. This procedure operated on the assumption that matter was originally corrupted, like man in the story of Genesis. The study of the transformations of corruption and limitation activated a mythological sequence in the mind of the alchemist. This sequence followed the pattern of the way upon which all religions have developed. Formal Christianity adopted the position that the sacrifice of Christ brought history to a close, and that belief in that sacrifice guaranteed redemption. Alchemy rejected that position in its pursuit of what remained unknown. In that heroic pursuit, the alchemist found himself transformed. As Jung states, whereas the Christian belief is that man is freed from sin by the redemptory act of Christ, the alchemist was evidently of the opinion that the restitution to the likeness of original and incorrupt nature had still to be accomplished by the art. And this can only mean that Christ's work of redemption was regarded as incomplete. In view of the wickedness which the prince of this world, undeterred, goes on perpetrating as liberally as before, one cannot withhold all sympathy from such an opinion. For an alchemist who professed allegiance to the Ecclesia Spiritualis it was naturally of supreme importance to make himself an unspotted vessel of the Paraclete, and thus to realize the idea Christ on a plane far transcending a mere imitation of him. This realization of Christ on a plane transcending imitation is an overwhelming idea. It makes of religious belief something far more than belief, something far more terrifying and far more promising. The sequence of the alchemical transformation paralleled Christ's passion, paralleled the myth of the hero and his redemption. The essential message of alchemy is that individual rejection of tyranny, voluntary pursuit of the unknown and terrifying, predicated upon faith in the ideal, may engender an individual transformation so overwhelming that its equivalent can only be found in the most profound of religious myths. Jung cites German alchemist Heinrich Kuhnrath. The son of the great world who is Theocosmos, i.e. a divine power and world, but whom even today, unfortunately, many who teach nature in a pagan spirit and many builders of medical science reject in the high university schools, is the exemplar of the stone which is Theanthropos, i.e. God and man, whom, as scripture tells us, the builders of the church have also rejected. And from the same, in and from the great world book of nature, there issues a continuous and everlasting doctrine for the wise and their children. Indeed, it is a splendid living likeness of our Savior Jesus Christ, in and from the great world, which by nature is very similar to him, as to miraculous conception, birth, inexpressible powers, virtues, and effects. So God, our Lord, besides his Son's biblical histories, has also created a specific image and natural representation for us in the book of nature. It was in pursuit of the unknown that the alchemist experienced this psychological transformation, just as it was originally in contact with the unknown that the monotheistic patriarchal system developed in the furthest reaches of history. It is the symbolic expression of the action of instinct, which manifests itself in some variant of the hero myth whenever the unknown is pursued without avoidance in the attempt to improve life. The alchemist experienced what the individual always experiences when he determines to face every aspect of his existence, individual and collective, without denial or recourse to sterile preconceptions. As Jung comments, the passion that vibrates in the alchemical text is genuine, but would be totally incomprehensible if the lapis were nothing but a chemical substance. Nor does it originate in contemplation of Christ's passion. It is the real experience of a man who has got involved in the compensatory contents of the unconscious by investigating the unknown seriously and to the point of self-sacrifice. He could not but see the likeness of his projected contents to the dogmatic images, which were in fact likely utilized by the instinctual procedure, and he might have been tempted to assume that his ideas were nothing else than the familiar religious conceptions which he was using in order to explain the chemical procedure. But the texts show clearly that, on the contrary, a real experience of the opus had an increasing tendency to assimilate the dogma or to amplify itself with it. In Christianity, spirit descends to matter, and the result of the union is the birth of Christ and, unfortunately, the formal realization of his opponent. In alchemy, which compensated for the one-sided view of Christianity, matter rises to spirit with analogous result, creation of the lapis or philosophical stone, which bears an unmistakable resemblance to Christ embodied in abstractly material form. This form, the philosopher's stone, the lapis, was composed of the most paradoxical elements. It was base, cheap, immature, and volatile, perfect, precious, ancient, and solid, visible to all, yet mysterious, costly, dark, hidden and evident, having one name and many names. The lapis was also the renewed king, the wise old man, and the child. The wise old man possesses the charisma of wisdom, which is the knowledge that transcends the limits of history. The child represents the creative spirit, the possibility in man, the Holy Ghost. He is not the child of ignorance, but the innocence of maturity. He precedes and antedates history in the subjective and collective sense. As Jung comments, "The child is all that is abandoned and exposed, and at the same time divinely powerful, the insignificant, dubious beginning and the triumphal end. The eternal child in man is an indescribable experience, an incongruity, a handicap, and a divine prerogative, an imponderable that determines the ultimate worth or worthlessness of a personality." This final value, the goal of the pursuit of the alchemists, is discovery and embodiment of the meaning of life itself. Integrated, subjective being actively expressing its nature through manipulation of the possibilities inherent in the material/unknown world. This final goal is the production of an integrated intrapsychic condition, identical to that of the mythological hero, acted out in a world regarded as equivalent to the self. Production of this condition, the lapis philosophorum, constitutes the antidote for the corruption of the world attendant upon the fall, attendant upon the emergence of partial self-consciousness. The lapis is agent of transformation, equivalent to the mythological redemptive hero, able to turn base metals into gold. It is, as such, something more valuable than gold, just as the hero is more valuable than any of his concrete productions. The complete alchemical opus, with production of the lapis as goal, is presented schematically in Figure 66, the alchemical opus as myth of redemption. Alchemy was a living myth, the myth of the individual man as redeemer. Organized Christianity had sterilized itself, so to speak, by insisting on the worship of some external truth as the means to salvation. The alchemists rediscovered the error of this presumption and came to realize that identification with the Redeemer was in fact necessary, not his worship. That myths of redemption had true power when they were incorporated and acted out, rather than believed in some abstract sense. This meant to say that Christ was the greatest man in history, a combination of the divine and mortal, was not sufficient expression of faith. Sufficient expression meant the attempt to live out the myth of the hero within the confines of individual personality, to voluntarily shoulder the cross of existence, to unite the opposites within a single breast, and to serve as active, conscious mediator between the eternal generative forces of known and unknown. Conclusion. The divinity of interest. Anomalies manifest themselves on the border between chaos and order, so to speak, and have a threatening and promising aspect. The promising aspect dominates when the contact is voluntary, when the exploring agent is up to date, when the individual has explored all previous anomalies, released the information they contained, and built a strong personality and steady world from that information. The threatening aspect dominates when the contact is involuntary, when the exploring agent is not up to date, when the individual has run away from evidence of his previous errors, failed to extract the information lurking behind his mistakes, weakened his personality, and destabilized his world. The phenomenon of interest, that precursor to exploratory behavior, signals the presence of a potentially beneficial anomaly. Interest manifests itself where an assimilable but novel phenomenon exists, where something new hides in a partially comprehensible form. Devout adherence to the dictates of interest, assuming a suitably disciplined character, therefore ensures stabilization and renewal of personality and world. Interest is a spirit beckoning from the unknown, a spirit calling from outside the walls of society. Pursuit of individual interest means hearkening to this spirit's call, journeying outside the protective walls of childhood dependence and adolescent group identification, and returning to rejuvenate society. This means that pursuit of individual interest, development of true individuality, is equivalent to identification with the hero. Such identification renders the world bearable despite its tragedies and reduces neurotic suffering, which destroys faith, to an absolute minimum. This is the message that everyone wants to hear. Risk your security. Face the unknown. Quit lying to yourself and do what your heart truly tells you to do. You will be better for it, and so will the world. From On the Genealogy of Morals by Friedrich Nietzsche. Introduction. Where does one not encounter that veiled glance which burdens one with a profound sadness, that inward-turned glance of the born failure which betrays how such a man speaks to himself, that glance which is a sigh? If only I were someone else, sighs this glance. But there is no hope of that. I am who I am. How could I ever get free of myself? And yet, I am sick of myself. It is on such soil, on swampy ground, that every weed, every poisonous plant grows, always so small, so hidden, so false, so saccharine. Here the worms of vengefulness and rancor swarm. Here the air stinks of secrets and concealment. Here the web of the most malicious of all conspiracies is being spun constantly. The conspiracy of the suffering against the well-constituted and victorious. Here the aspect of the victorious is hated. And what mendaciousness is employed to disguise that this hatred is hatred? What a display of grand words and postures! What an art of honest calumny! These failures, what noble eloquence flows from their lips! How much sugary, slimy, humble submissiveness swims in their eyes. What do they really want? At least to represent justice, love, wisdom, superiority. That is the ambition of the lowest, the sick. And how skillful such an ambition makes them. Admire above all the forger's skill with which the stamp of virtue, even the ring, the golden-sounding ring of virtue, is here counterfeited. They monopolize virtue, these weak, hopelessly sick people. There is no doubt of it. We alone are the good and just, they say. We alone are homines bonae voluntatis. They walk among us as embodied reproaches, as warnings to us, as if health, well-constitutedness, strength, pride, and sense of power were in themselves necessarily vicious things for which one must pay some day and pay bitterly. How ready they themselves are at bottom to make one pay. How they crave to be hangmen. I was reading Geoffrey Burton Russell's Mephistopheles, The Devil in the Modern World, when I came across his discussion of Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. Russell discusses Ivan's argument for atheism, which is perhaps the most powerful ever mounted. He states, Ivan's examples of evil, all taken from the daily newspapers of 1876, are unforgettable. The nobleman who orders his hounds to tear the peasant boy to pieces in front of his mother. The man who whips his struggling horse on its gentle eyes. The parents who lock their tiny daughter all night in the freezing privy while she knocks on the walls pleading for mercy. the Turk who entertains a baby with a shiny pistol before blowing its brains out. Ivan knows that such horrors occur daily and can be multiplied without end. I took the case of children, Ivan explains, to make my case clearer. Of the other tears with which the earth is soaked, I will say nothing. Russell continues. The relation of evil to God has in the century of Auschwitz and Hiroshima once again become a center of philosophical and theological discussion. The problem of evil can be stated simply. God is omnipotent. God is perfectly good. Such a God would not permit evil to exist. But we observe that evil exists. Therefore, God does not exist. Variations on this theme are nearly infinite. The problem is not only abstract and philosophical, of course, it is also personal and immediate. Believers tend to forget that their God takes away everything that one cares about, possessions, comforts, success, profession or craft, knowledge, friends, family, and life. What kind of God is this? Any decent religion must face this question squarely, and no answer is credible that cannot be given in the face of dying children. It seems to me that we use the horrors of the world to justify our own inadequacies. We make the presumption that human vulnerability is a sufficient cause of human cruelty. We blame God and God's creation for twisting and perverting our souls and claim all the time to be innocent victims of circumstance. What do you say to a dying child? You say, "You can do it. There is something in you that is strong enough to do it." And you don't use the terrible vulnerability of children as an excuse for the rejection of existence and the perpetration of conscious evil. When I wrote this audiobook, I did not have much experience as a clinical psychologist. Two of my patients, however, stayed in my mind. The first was a woman, about 35 years old. She looked 50. She reminded me of a medieval peasant. Of my conception of a medieval peasant. She was dirty, clothes, hair, teeth, dirty with the kind of filth that takes months to develop. She was unbearably shy. She approached anyone who she thought was superior in status to her, which was virtually everyone, hunched over, with her eyes shaded by her hands, both hands, as if she could not tolerate the light emanating from her target. She had been in behavioral treatment in Montreal as an outpatient before and was in fact a sight known to the permanent staff at the clinic. Others had tried to help her overcome her unfortunate manner of self-presentation, which made people on the street shy away from her, made them regard her as crazy and unpredictable. She could learn to stand or sit up temporarily with eyes unguarded, but she reverted to her old habits as soon as she left the clinic. She may have been intellectually impaired in consequence of some biological fault. It was difficult to tell because her environment was so appalling it may have caused her ignorance. She was illiterate as well. She lived with her mother, whose character I knew nothing about, and with an elderly, desperately ill, bedridden aunt. Her boyfriend was a violent, alcoholic schizophrenic who mistreated her psychologically and physically and was always muddling her simple mind with tirades about the devil. She had nothing going for her, no beauty, no intelligence, no loving family, no skills, no creative employment, nothing. She didn't come to therapy to resolve her problems, however, nor to unburden her soul, nor to describe her mistreatment and victimization at the hands of others. She came because she wanted to do something for someone who was worse off than her. The clinic where I was interning was associated with a large psychiatric hospital. All of the patients that still remained after the shift to community care in the aftermath of the 60s were so incapacitated that they could not survive, however poorly, on the streets. My client had done some volunteer work of some limited type in that hospital and decided that she might befriend a patient, take him or her outside for a walk. I think she got this idea because she had a dog which she walked regularly and which she liked to take care of. All she wanted from me was help arranging this, help finding someone whom she could take outside, help finding someone in the hospital bureaucracy who would allow this to happen. I was not very successful in aiding her, but she didn't seem to hold that against me. It is said that one piece of evidence that runs contrary to a theory is sufficient to disprove that theory. Of course, people do not think this way, and perhaps should not. In general, a theory is too useful to give up easily, too difficult to regenerate, and the evidence against should be consistent and believable before it is accepted. But the existence of this woman made me think. She was destined for a psychopathological end from the viewpoint of biological and environmental determinism, fated as surely as anyone I had ever met. And maybe she kicked her dog sometimes and was rude to her sick aunt. Maybe. I never saw her vindictive or unpleasant, even when her simple wishes were thwarted. I don't want to say that she was a saint, because I didn't know her well enough to tell. But the fact was that in her misery and simplicity, she remained without self-pity and could still see outside of herself. Why wasn't she corrupted, cruel, unbalanced, and miserable? She had every reason to be, and yet she wasn't. In her simple way, she had made the proper choices. She remained bloody but unbowed, and she seemed to me, rightly or wrongly, to be a symbol of suffering humanity, sorely afflicted, yet capable of courage and love. Such I created all the ethereal powers and spirits, both them who stood and them who failed. Not free, what proof could they have given sincere of true allegiance, constant faith, or love, where only what they needs must do appeared, not what they would? What praise could they receive? What pleasure I from such obedience paid? When will and reason also is choice, useless and vain, of freedom both despoiled, made passive both, had served necessity, not me. They, therefore, as to right belonged, so were created, nor can justly accuse their maker, or their making, or their fate, as if predestination overruled their will, disposed by absolute decree or high foreknowledge. They themselves decreed their own revolt, not I. If I foreknew, foreknowledge had no influence on their fault, which had no less proved certain unforeknown. So, without least impulse or shadow of fate, or aught by me immutably foreseen, they trespass, authors to themselves, in all, both what they judge and what they choose. For so I formed them free, and free they must remain till they enthrall themselves. I else must change their nature and revoke the high decree, unchangeable, eternal, which ordained their freedom. They themselves ordained their fall. God Almighty speaking in Milton, Paradise Lost. The other patient I wish to describe was a schizophrenic in a small inpatient ward at a different hospital. He was about 29 when I met him, a few years older than I was at the time, and had been in and out of confinement for 7 years. He was, of course, on antipsychotic medication and participated in occupational therapy activities on the ward, making coasters and pencil holders and so on, but he could not maintain attention for any amount of time and was not even much good at craft. My supervisor asked me to administer an intelligence test to him, the standard WACE-R, more for the sake of my experience than for any possible diagnostic good. I gave my patient some of the red and white blocks that made up the block design subtest. He was supposed to arrange the blocks so they matched a pattern printed on some cards. He picked them up and started to rearrange them on the desk in front of him while I timed him, stupidly, with a stopwatch. The task was impossible for him, even at the simplest of stages. He looked constantly distracted and frustrated. I asked, "What's wrong?" He said, "The battle between good and evil in heaven is going on in my head." I stopped the testing at that point. I didn't know exactly what to make of his comment. He was obviously suffering, and the testing seemed to make it worse. What was he experiencing? He wasn't lying, that was for sure. In the face of such a statement, it seemed ridiculous to continue. I spent some time with him that summer. I had never met someone who was so blatantly mentally ill. We talked on the ward, and occasionally I would take him for a walk through the hospital grounds. He was the third son of first-generation immigrants. His firstborn brother was a lawyer, the other a physician. His parents were obviously ambitious for their children, hard-working and disciplined. He had been a graduate student working toward a degree in immunology, perhaps. I don't precisely remember. His brothers had set him a daunting example, and he felt pressure to succeed. His experimental work had not turned out as he had expected, however, and he apparently came to believe that he might not graduate. Not, at least, when he had hoped to. So he faked his experimental results and wrote up his thesis anyway. He told me that the night he finished writing, he woke up and saw the devil standing over him at the foot of his bed. This event triggered the onset of his mental illness, from which he had never recovered. It might be said that the satanic apparition merely accompanied the expression of some pathological stress-induced neural development whose appearance was biologically predetermined, or that the devil was merely personification of his culture's conception of moral evil manifesting itself in imagination as a consequence of his guilt. Both explanations have their merits. But the fact remains that he saw the devil, and that the vision accompanied or even was the event that destroyed him. He was afraid to tell me much of his fantasy, and it was only after I had paid careful attention to him that he opened up. He was not bragging or trying to impress me. He was terrified about what he believed, terrified as a consequence of the fantasies that impressed themselves upon him. He told me that he could not leave the hospital because someone was waiting to shoot him, a typical paranoid delusion. Why did someone want to kill him? Well, he was hospitalized during the Cold War, not at its height, perhaps, but still during a time when the threat of purposeful nuclear annihilation seemed more plausible than it does now. Many of the people I knew used the existence of this threat to justify to themselves their failure to participate fully in life, a life which they thought of romantically as doomed and therefore as pointless. But there was some real terror in the pose, and the thought of the countless missiles pointed here and there around the world sapped the energy and faith of everyone, hypocritical or not. My schizophrenic patient believed that he was, in fact, the incarnation of the world-annihilating force, that he was destined upon his release from the hospital to make his way south to a nuclear missile silo on American territory, that he was fated to make the decision that would launch the final war. The people outside the hospital knew this, and that is why they were waiting to shoot him. He did not want to tell me this story in consequence, although he did, because he thought I might then want to kill him too. My friends in graduate school thought it ironic that I had contact with a patient of this type. My peculiar interest in Jung was well known to them, and it seemed absurdly fitting that I would end up talking to someone with delusions of this type. But I didn't know what to do with his ideas. Of course, they were crazy, and they had done in my patient. But it still seemed to me that they were true from the metaphorical viewpoint. His story in totality linked his individual choice between good and evil with the cumulative horror then facing the world. His story implied that because he had given in to temptation at a critical juncture, he was in fact responsible for the horror of the potential of nuclear war. But how could this be? It seemed insane to me to even consider that the act of one powerless individual could be linked in some manner to the outcome of history as a whole. But I am no longer so sure. I have read much about evil and its manner of perpetration and growth, and I am no longer convinced that each of us is so innocent, so harmless. It is, of course, illogical to presume that one person, one speck of dust among 6 billion motes, is in any sense responsible for the horrible course of human events. But that course in itself is not logical, far from it, and it seems likely that it depends on processes that we do not understand. The most powerful arguments for the non-existence of God, at least a good God, are predicated on the idea that such a being would not allow for the existence of evil in its classical, natural diseases, disasters, or moral wars, pogroms, forms. Such arguments can be taken further even than atheism, can be used to dispute the justice of the existent world itself. Dostoevsky states, "Perhaps the entire cosmos is not worth a single child's suffering. How can the universe be constructed such that pain is permitted? How can a good God allow for the existence of a suffering world?" These difficult questions can be addressed in part as a consequence of careful analysis of evil. First, it seems reasonable to insist upon the value of the natural/moral distinction. The tragic circumstances of life should not be placed in the same category as willfully undertaken harm. Tragedy, subjugation to the mortal conditions of existence, has an ennobling aspect, at least in potential, and has been constantly exploited to that end in great literature and mythology. True evil, by contrast, is anything but noble. Participation in acts whose sole purpose is expansion of innocent pain and suffering destroys character. Forthright encounter with tragedy, by contrast, may increase it. This is the meaning of the Christian myth of the crucifixion. It is Christ's full participation in and freely chosen acceptance of his fate, which he shares with all mankind, that enables him to manifest his full identity with God. And it is that identity which enables him to bear his fate and which strips it of its evil. Conversely, it is the voluntary demeaning of our own characters that makes the necessary, tragic conditions of existence appear evil. But why is life tragic? Why are we subject to unbearable limitation, to pain, disease, and death, to cruelty at the hands of nature and society? Why do terrible things happen to everyone? These are, of course, unanswerable questions, but they must be answered somehow if we are to be able to face our own lives. The best I can make of it is this, and this has helped me. Nothing can exist without preconditions. Even a game cannot be played without rules, and the rules say what cannot be done as much as what can. Perhaps the world is not possible as a world without its borders, without its rules. Maybe existence wouldn't be possible in the absence of our painful limitations. Think of it this way. If we could have everything we wanted merely for wishing it, if every tool performed every job, if all men were omniscient and immortal, then everything would be the same all-powerful thing, God, and creation would not exist. It is the difference between things, which is a function of their specific limitations, that allows them to exist at all. But the fact that things do exist does not mean that they should exist, even if we are willing to grant them their necessary limitations. Should the world exist? Are the preconditions of experience so terrible that the whole game should be called off? There is never any shortage of people working diligently towards this end. It seems to me that we answer this question, implicitly but profoundly, when we lose someone we loved and grieve. We cry not because they existed, but because they are lost. This presupposes a judgment rendered at a very fundamental level. Grief presupposes having loved, presupposes the judgment that this person's specific, bounded existence was valuable, was something that should have been, even in its inevitably imperfect and vulnerable form. But still the question lingers. Why should things, even loved things, exist at all if their necessary limitations cause such suffering? Perhaps we could reserve answer to the question of God's nature, his responsibility for the presence of the evil in creation, until we have solved the problem of our own. Perhaps we could tolerate the horrors of the world if we left our own characters intact and developed them to the fullest, if we took full advantage of every gift we have been granted. Perhaps the world would not look horrible then. I dreamed I was walking up out of a deep valley along a paved two-lane highway. The highway was located in northern Alberta, where I grew up, and came out of the only valley for miles around in the endlessly flat prairie. I passed a man hitchhiking and could see another in the distance. As I approached him, I could see that he was in the first stages of old age, but he still looked terribly strong. Someone passed him in a car driving the opposite direction, and a female voice yelled, "Look out! He has a knife!" He was carrying what looked like a wooden-handled kitchen knife, well-worn and discolored, but it had a blade at least 2.5 feet long. Across his shoulder, he had strapped a large leather sheath. He was walking along the edge of the highway, muttering to himself and swinging the blade in a jerky and chaotic fashion. He looked like the landlord who lived next door to me when I was a graduate student living in a poor district in Montreal. My landlord was a powerful, aging ex-biker, former president of the local Hell's Angels chapter by his own account, who had spent some time in prison as a younger man. He had settled down somewhat typically as he became more mature and had brought his drinking under control for a long time. His wife committed suicide when I lived there, however, and he went back to his wilder ways. He often went on binge drinking sprees and spent all the money he earned in the electronics shop he ran out of his small apartment. He would drink 40 or even 50 beers in a single day and would return home in the evening, blind drunk, howling at his little dog, laughing, hissing between his teeth, incoherent, good-natured still, but able to become violent at the slightest provocation. He took me once to a favorite haunt on his 1200cc Honda, which had the acceleration of a jet plane for short distances, me perched precariously on the back of his bike, clinging to him, wearing his wife's helmet, which sat on my head ridiculously, uselessly, at least 5 sizes too small. Drunk, he was almost innocently destructive and ended up in fights constantly, unavoidably, as he would take slights from people whose paths he crossed who were insufficiently cautious in their conversation with him. I hurried by this figure. He seemed upset that no one would stop and pick him up, as if he were unaware of the danger he posed. As I went by, his gaze fell on me, and he started after me, not from anger, but from desire for companionship. He was not fast, however, and I easily stayed ahead of him on the road. The scene shifted. The knife-wielding figure and I were now on opposite sides of an immense tree, perhaps 100 yards in diameter, on a spiral staircase emerging from the dark below and ascending equally far above. The staircase was made of old, worn, dark wood. It reminded me of the pews in the church I attended with my mother as a child and where I was eventually married. The figure was looking for me, but he was a long way back, and I had hidden myself from his view as I ascended the staircase. I remember wanting to continue on my original journey out of the valley onto the flat surrounding plain where the walking would be easy. The only way to stay away from the knife, however, was to continue up the staircase, up the Axis Mundi. It is thus that awareness of death, the grim reaper, the terrible face of God, compels us inexorably upwards, towards a consciousness sufficiently heightened to bear the thought of death. The point of our limitations is not suffering. It is existence itself. We have been granted the capacity to voluntarily bear the terrible weight of our mortality. We turn from that capacity and degrade ourselves because we are afraid of responsibility. In this manner, the necessarily tragic preconditions of existence are made intolerable. It seems to me that it is not the earthquake, the flood, or the cancer that makes life unbearable, horrible as those events appear. We seem capable of withstanding natural disaster, even of responding to that disaster in an honorable and decent manner. It is rather the pointless suffering that we inflict upon each other, our evil, that makes life appear corrupt beyond acceptability, that undermines our ability to manifest faith in our central natures. So why should the capacity for evil exist? I have been teaching my 6-year-old daughter to play the piano. I am trying to teach her hard lessons. That is, trying to show her that there really is a right way to play the piano and a wrong way. The right way involves paying attention to each phrase, each written note, every sound she makes, every finger motion. I taught her what rhythm meant a few weeks ago in one difficult lesson. And what does difficult mean? Well, she will sit at the piano and work so hard that she cries. But she won't stop. And she is really interested in learning to play. She spends time in the car listening to music, working out the rhythms. She uses the metronome by herself, playing songs she likes, faster and slower. Yesterday, I taught her the difference between playing loudly and playing softly. She found this challenging, experimenting carefully with each key on her old piano, which has many idiosyncrasies, trying to determine exactly how hard it had to be pressed to emit a whispery tone. I woke up the morning after one of her lessons and caught a fragment of the end of a dream reverie. This is the idea revealed by that reverie. It is the fact that differences exist between passive action that makes actions worthwhile. I know that what is believed determines the value of things, but I had never taken this argument to its logical conclusion. If belief determines value, then the distance between good and evil gives life its meaning. The more worthwhile a path of action, which is to say, the better it is, the more it is good rather than evil, the more positive emotional valence that path contains. This means that things have no meaning because no differential value for those who do not believe in good and evil. I have certainly known people in that position, although I did not know explicitly that they were in that position because they did not know the difference between good and evil. They were unable to do anything because they could not tell the difference between one path and another. And it is the case that in the absence of differences between one thing and another, life begins to appear a cruel and meaningless joke, to use Tolstoy's phrase. I guess that is because the burdens of life do not appear worth sustaining in the absence of evidence that striving and work have any real value. This all means value is a continuum, a line stretching from necessary point A to necessary point B. A and B are defined in relation to one another as two points define a line. The polarity between the two determines the valence of the goal. The more polarity, that is, the more tension, between the two points, the more worthwhile the enterprise. Good cannot be defined, cannot exist in the absence of evil. Value cannot exist in the absence of polarity. So, for the world to be worthwhile, that is, for the choice between two things to constitute a real choice, both good and evil have to exist. But then it would be possible to only choose good, at least in the ideal, and then evil would not exist, except in potential. So it appears that the world could be valuable, could justify the burden it requires to maintain, if evil were only to exist in potential, if everyone chose to act properly, that is. This seems to me to be the most optimistic thought I have ever encountered. But how can we put an end to our errors? What path can we follow to eliminate our blindness and stupidity, to bring us closer to the light? Christ said, "Be ye therefore perfect, as your Father in heaven is perfect." But how? We seem stymied, as always, by Pontius Pilate's ironic query, "What is truth?" John 18:38. Well, even if we don't know precisely what the truth is, we can certainly tell each of us what it isn't. It isn't greed and the desire above all else for constant material gain. It isn't denial of experience we know full well to be real and the infliction of suffering for the purpose of suffering. Perhaps it is possible to stop doing those things which we know beyond doubt to be wrong, to become self-disciplined and honest, and to therefore become ever more able to perceive the nature of the positive good. The truth seems painfully simple, so simple that it is a miracle of sorts that it can ever be forgotten. Love God with all thy mind and all thy acts and all thy heart. This means serve truth above all else and treat your fellow man as if he were yourself, not with the pity that undermines his self-respect and not with the justice that elevates you above him, but as a divinity heavily burdened who could yet see the light. It is said that it is more difficult to rule oneself than a city, and this is no metaphor. This is truth, as literal as it can be made. It is precisely for this reason that we keep trying to rule the city. It is a perversion of pride to cease praying in public and to clean up the dust under our feet instead. It seems too mundane to treat those we actually face with respect and dignity when we could be active against in the street. Maybe it is more important to strengthen our characters than to repair the world. So much of that reparation seems selfish anyway. Is selfishness and intellectual pride masquerading as love, creating a world polluted with good works that don't work? Who can believe that it is the little choices we make every day between good and evil that turn the world to waste and hope to despair? But it is the case. We see our immense capacity for evil constantly realized before us in great things and in small, but can never seem to realize our infinite capacity for good. Who can argue with a Solzhenitsyn when he states, "One man who stops lying can bring down a tyranny"? Christ said, "The kingdom of heaven is spread out upon the earth, but men do not see it." What if it was nothing but our self-deceit, our cowardice, hatred, and fear that pollutes our experience and turns the world into hell? This is a hypothesis, at least, as good as any